Hello and welcome along. This is the RTÉ Rugby Podcast. The BKT United Rugby Championship playoffs are upon us. Two provinces remain. We'll be talking about Leinster versus the Scarlets and Sharks versus Munster a little bit later. Bordeaux Begle have won their first Investec Champions Cup, beating Northampton Saints, a game that's had a bitter fallout over the last few days. There's also a Club World Cup coming up in 2028 we need to talk about. So lots to get through with Bernard Jackman and Johnny Murphy. How are you doing, lads?
Good, thank you.
Let's start with the Champions Cup final on Saturday. Bordeaux win 28-20. Northampton held scoreless in a Champions Cup final second half again. A cracking first half, though, 20-20 at the break. We saw a couple of disallowed tries over the course of the game on both sides. There were some yellow cards. Perhaps Bordeaux lucky enough not to get a red card as well over the course of the game. But Bernard, we'd kind of said it all season. No doubts about Bordeaux in terms of their talent and how good they are in attack. We questioned the steel that they have. We would have said that they're a little bit of a flaky team that, you know, we would have predicted ahead of when Munster were playing them. We would have said Ulster were getting so many opportunities. They let teams back into games. Did you get a good answer that they've kind of washed a bit of that out of their system now?
Yeah, I thought it was a very composed, professional performance from obviously Northampton. Struck early with that try from Alex Coles, and he would have thought, okay, this is going to test the mettle of Bordeaux. Obviously, half time, 20 all. Again, they're going to have to deal with that. And the problem, obviously, of last year, losing the Harlequins in the knockout stages, losing to, getting hammered in the top 14 final, and some of the flakiness we've seen during the year. But in actual fact, when I think back now, and I take into account the final, think the semi-final against Toulouse, where they were up against an opponent who obviously they respected earlier on in the year when they beat Toulouse back-to-back in the top 14. They seem to be a team who have mental lapses, but probably against opponents who are inferior, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think if you think back to the Ulster and Munster games, or some of their group games, it was nearly like they were toying with the opposition. It was like they felt they could score at ease. Whereas against Northampton and Toulouse in the last two rounds, it was like they knew they couldn't have those mental lapses and were just unbelievably focused. And I thought Luku was outstanding, obviously, in terms of just that game management. It allowed Jalibert to do what he does. And obviously, he got so much flair and power with like Mofana and Penno and Bia Barry and Bourras. It's important that you have a nine who plays the percentages, and I thought he did really well. And you would wonder now, are they going to become a superpower? I mean, Toulouse are obviously going to be back with DuPont and the type of player that they're producing year on year. But the Bordeaux Academy is also full of young talent as well. And obviously, we know that they get the biggest crowds in pro rugby, a wealthy president who's passionate about it, a fan base now who are going to be galvanised, a city with a soccer club in the third division. You know, rugby is now the city or the sport of Bordeaux City in the region. So they could be a team like Toulon, you know, back when they dominated Europe. Obviously, it's set up differently. Toulon were mainly world stars from different countries come together, but Bordeaux are mainly French, and they're a joy to watch. And they're an exciting prospect, I think, going forward.
It does feel like it's the start of something, Johnny, rather than the end of a journey for Bordeaux.
Yeah, well, I think getting over the line now in terms of getting a medal in their pocket and lifting a trophy, and having, you know, those, you know, learning from, as Bert said, those mental lapses in the earlier rounds and a bit of disappointment over, you know, last year, I think it sets them up to understand what it takes to win a big competition, to be, you know, on the game, and they control that second half. Their kicking game was very good. They obviously had a clear tactic in terms of going after a chip space in the middle of the pitch. They went after that a couple of times. And then just with their, you combine the speed they have with the kicking game, it just puts teams, when they do look to play territory, puts them under so much pressure because they have guys who kind of hair out of the line. And then also any kind of loose kicks on the ground, you know, bouncing ball, if you can get another foot on it, they have the speed that can, you know, they can score tries off those, you know, those loose bouncing balls. But yeah, it was a great final. There's obviously a lot of talking points. They obviously, from a mental perspective, with kind of what went on during the game and after the game. People are obviously speaking about it. You know, they obviously had built up, you know, the Henry Pollock stuff throughout this. So they really used that in the, you know, pre-game, in-game, and then obviously on socials and different stuff post-game. So it was, you know, obviously mentally they're using these things to give them a bit of an edge in for the final. So, but yeah, it's a cracking final. First half was class, you know, just in terms of how it went. I do think Northampton were probably unlucky and they didn't get the rub of the green on a number of things. The early injuries to them, the injuries pre-game, and then the you know, losing Augustus, and then obviously the injuries in-game so early really kind of messed any plans they had, and they were probably at plan C or plan D towards the last kind of 10, 15 minutes. And then a couple of decisions and a couple of TMOs, things that weren't looked at, do go against them. But, you know, did the best team win? Probably, you know. So, but they were, I do feel, particularly for Sam, I was kind of, they just didn't get any luck in those moments that could have gone their way, you know. But yeah, it was a cracking final to watch.
Hey, let's talk. You mentioned, I suppose, the bit of the fallout that's come in the last few days, and most of it is around Henry Pollock, and Bordeaux obviously clearly painted him as the villain leading into the game. There's quotes from Damien Penaud talking about he'd labelled them as a bunch of mercenaries and all this sort of stuff. Nobody can actually find these Henry Pollock quotes, by the way, where he called them all a bunch of mercenaries. So it feels like a lot of it has kind of just been pulled out of thin air or gone through a few different versions of Google Translate to get the version they wanted. But like the pulse check celebration that he was doing against Leinster, some of the players were still doing, the Bordeaux players were still taking the mick out of that by Monday, which felt a little bit like, all right, lads, okay, I think you've made your point here now. Let's just move on from this. There was also a citing, Bernard, for Jefferson Poirot for grabbing him by the neck of the game.
Yeah.
There's no decision out on it yet. From what we can see on the footage, I'm not sure where that's coming from. Because if that is a sighting or that's a suspension or a red card, Peter O'Mahony or Eben Etzebeth wouldn't have had particularly long rugby careers.
Yeah, and I just got an email.
Johnson, for that matter.
What?
I got an email. Mark Johnson. Yeah. I just got an email about Sam Underhill. He's got 4 weeks, so that decision is out. If there's, like, if the only footage or the incident is the incident that I've seen, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. You'd wonder, like, I'd be absolutely shocked if there's any kind of punishment for Poirot. You know, obviously Northampton afterwards mentioned it and hope the sighting officer looked at it. But I think if it is the footage that we've seen, it better off just move on. You know, there was obviously a little bit of heat of the moment stuff said at the very end. There was a bit of a push, but unless they have another angle, I can't see it happen to him really. And even having to go face disciplinary seems a bit over severe and not really taking into account the emotion that would have been there at the end. Like, the Bordeaux lads are obviously they definitely created some kind of a mentality or narrative that Northampton and in particular Pollock were arrogant, and that mercenary thing. I also haven't seen it said. Now, unless it was said during the game, but they're certainly enjoying the celebrations. I think there'll be some shape now for this weekend against Toulon away. I think they're still on the beer. I saw Big Ben Taufmea dressed up as a policeman yesterday in Bordeaux. So look at this. It's a monumental achievement, and they're right to celebrate. It was interesting, actually. The president after the match said the top 14 is the biggest thing for him and the club, you know, but they've really enjoyed this journey in Europe, and it's kind of taught them about how big Europe is. And obviously we're going to talk a little bit later about that World Cup, but you know, straight away he said, no, the top 14 is the ultimate goal for us. But yeah, they're certainly bonding anyway.
I do think on the sighting thing, it seems as if it's a bit reactionary in terms of what was said post game, but also there's three or four incidents in the game where, you felt there could have been sidings for neck grabs. Like, you know, there's a neck roll, Northampton have one, and the referee's like, but there's no twisting motion. But like, he's choking him out, you know? Yeah. And then there's a couple for the Bordeaux centre where he clears out and he grabs someone. And again, those incidences in-game probably would have warranted, in my opinion, more of a sighting than something at the end. Like, you know, the idea that a neck roll isn't a neck roll unless you twist someone, but your arms are still, like, it's a chokehold, you know? And there was two or three of those throughout the game that probably could have been looked at. But that, I don't see the one at the end where if any one of those, particularly maybe the Northampton one, and there was one from the centre post when he gets high and then he grabs and then pulls him. But, like, I think they potentially warranted more of a sighting than the ones post-game.
On Pollock specifically, we've reached this, it's a really interesting point in this breakthrough season that he's having where there's no surprise anymore if he's playing unbelievable or if he is the kind of target man in the team. But teams have obviously realised now that, no, we actually have to go out and put a bit of manners on him. And, like, it's brilliant for the game that he's a bit cocky and he's a bit arrogant and he's not afraid to kind of ruffle a few feathers and annoy the opposition a little bit. But you get the feeling, Bernard, he probably is realising now that if you dish it out, you're going to have to be able to take it because teams are going to put a target on his back. And, like, just wait till we get to Australia and what the Australians have planned to rile him up during games. It's just going to be interesting to see how everyone and he reacts to it.
Yeah, I think so. I think I would like to see him change. I think he still had a very good game. But obviously he came out in the losing side and he didn't have the big moment. Obviously he had two potential tries. Disallowed the first one for me in front of the kicker, which I actually wouldn't have mind. That was one of the ones I wouldn't have minded Timo having had a look at it, but unfortunately the referee had blown up straight away. So he seemed to have a good view of it. But for my line, it was definitely marginal enough. I think he would have won that foot race. And I think Northampton coaching box thought he would have as well because they said there was a video or footage of them celebrating it. And the other one was that front peel where, okay, there's a tug of a jersey, or two tugs of a jersey, but he's still a good finish. You know what I mean? It's that fend and that speed. I think he's an exceptional player. I think it's just, unfortunately for him, the way the game ended and him kind of looking for referee to get involved and that's not a good look, you know. I think be yourself, but be kind of be graceful and magnanimous. Be a respectful loser as well, and he's just got to manage that part of it. But yeah, the Aussies are going to tear into him. But I think he's okay. I think he lives off that, and it's just a case of whether it becomes too much of a negative talking point for the team he plays in. If you get me, you know. Yeah. And if he did come out during the week and kind of get Bordeaux with that narrative that he said they were mercenaries. I actually don't think he did. I think what I've read is Northampton really used the message around how connected they are, right? And how tight they are as a kind of a rallying point and something that they could gather belief in. And I sense that Bordeaux felt, because they were emphasizing that so much, it was some kind of slight against them not being connected, and I just gave them a little bit more of a cause. But the reality was, I think at the end of the day, Bordeaux were the best team and had the best talent, the best players, and performed the best, and they deserve to win it. So I don't think you could argue that whether, you know, you gave them a little bit more of a cause or a bit of a an angle or narrative that led to it. The reality was, and probably all year, Bordeaux have been the best team, to be fair. You know, top seeds, played some of the most outstanding rugby, and they did it on the biggest stage in the final, so fair play to them.
I think it comes from probably the seven-minute clip that Northampton released after semi-final, in terms of the language that they were using around what Leinster were and that they're built differently, and how they were pre-game, you know, what they used in their language in the dressing room at halftime and all of that. They probably tried to use that and connect that to what, well, they've said that about Leinster, so this is what they're going to do. So, and like, look, I think that's brilliant, because fair play to Northampton for releasing that. Like, that's what everyone wants to see. That goes.
Yeah, it was great. It was brilliant insight.
Yeah, yeah, and like that then, but like Bert's already said it, like Northampton and he in particular, if they're six and the mall gets up the mall where he should do, that the prop doesn't get held back because he's in the mall and he actually has a grasp of them in the mall. Like, that's just a good bit of cheating. He just missed time that. And then if Pollock's half a foot deeper, he probably scores that. So it's, you know, that Northampton could go on and win it. So it's not anything that Northampton were giving them ammunition. It's two tiny, tight calls in all finals that it comes down to. But yeah, like, it probably comes from something like that, from a social media perspective, which is brilliant. And that's what you want to see.
I want to know what big cocky celebrations a 20-year-old Johnny Murphy had back in the day. Who were you?
I'd have to ask the Lansdowne lads. I was more into trying to get my weekly money out of the lads, like Steve Rooney and those lads on the buses and the trains back. But that was it, yeah. It was very early in Leicester, so there wasn't very many celebrations. So that out of me very quickly over there.
I'd park the Champions Cup final for now. I was going to dedicate 20 minutes, Birch, to Maxime Lamas, the Bordeaux hooker, being about 3 yards on the pitch when he was throwing balls into lineouts. We can do that another day, though.
Yeah.
We can do that another day. Also confirmed over the weekend, 2028, we're going to have the first Rugby World Club Cup. Now, this has been kind of touted for a few years, but it was finally confirmed by Dominic Mackay, the EPCR chairperson, I think around the day of the Champions Cup final, or the day before the Champions Cup final, a few days ago. So it's going to happen in 2028. Every 4 years, 2032 then. It's essentially going to replace the quarterfinals onwards of that season's Champions Cup. So in 2028, we're not going to have a Champions Cup winner. The 8 teams who go through to the quarterfinals of the Champions Cup, or would in a normal season go through to the Champions Cup quarterfinals, they will head off to this Rugby World Club Cup, which will take place that June. You'll also have 7 teams from Super Rugby and 1 from Japan. And they all fight it out in a location to be determined, or maybe it's happening over multiple cities across Europe or across Australia or New Zealand. I think all those details are probably yet to be finalised. General thoughts on it, Bernard?
Look, I actually think devalues the Champions Cup, to be fair, because you're not going to have a winner every 4 years. It's a different competition. I think the best solution is to try and focus on how you can actually get the Champions Cup back to having more games that are ultra important. And I think the knockout stages of the Champions Cup, we've seen some brilliant rugby, but I think obviously in the group stages and the qualification for the knockout stages has been too lenient. So you're not getting that jeopardy, you're not getting that must win mindset I think we all loved about the old format. And I would have been happy with the winners of the Champions Cup playing the winners of Super Rugby in a one-off game, or over two legs or whatever. For me, that would have been a fitting World Cup. So, but I also have to say, like, the game is struggling to bring new fans, to bring revenue. So I don't want to be too critical of people who are trying to actually do something different as well. But my gut on this is that we had a very good competition, and the tinkering with us has devalued it to a certain extent. And that's where the issue is. But yeah, it's going to be nice to see, you know, a Munster or an Ulster or Leinster play the Chiefs. You know what I mean? There is going to be, I am interested in that per se, but then you're also going to have the issue of how many of those teams or how many of the Champions Cup teams will believe they can win it, and it's a competition worth winning, and we're going to see half-arsed games in that, depending on travel, etc. So, like, that's also a worry for me at the moment, without that absolute clarity around what the value of winning it is, or getting to a final is, what the cost is going to be in terms of their own domestic competitions. You know, like I just mentioned, Bordeaux saying the top 14 is their priority. It's the biggest thing to them. We know other top 14 clubs have a similar mindset and don't believe they can win the Champions Cup. So will they believe they can win a World Cup? You know what I mean? Will it actually make some of that group well, it makes the group stages for the European Cup that year even more farcical at times, where teams actually don't want to go and play an away leg in Australia. I don't know where the travel is around that, but you know, they're the questions in my mind at the moment until I see exact details around what that looks like post qualification for it. I'm gonna hold my opinion.
I don't know what your thoughts are on it, Johnny. For me, it just like it all feels a little bit too late. 10 years ago, everyone was talking about how great an idea this would have been because Super Rugby was like at such a high level, and I think we've reached a point now where Super Rugby has dropped off a little bit. France have gone to another level entirely compared to every other league, and then you look at the layout of what they're proposing, where it's 8 teams from the Champions Cup, plus 7 from Super Rugby and 1 from Japan. Is Super Rugby good enough at the moment where they get 7 teams? France potentially only get 2 or 3. South Africa might have won. Ireland might have won in there. England might have 1 or 2. I don't know. The weighting of it all feels a little bit off. And I don't know. I just think it's a few years too late. I don't think it's what we need now.
Yeah, look, they're obviously trying to do something in terms of, you know, growing the game and giving people an appetite for a world game and trying to entice that. I do think they probably, by having the structure of it, as you say, they're probably diluting it a bit. Maybe, you know, a hybrid would have been the semi-finals from each competition potentially going into it and going, you know, trying to manage that with no group stages might be a bit easier, or even the two finalists or, you know, logistically, how do you do that? But like someone like Cast, who like that in the new format, they have always been, they don't send their teams away because they concentrate, they have a smaller squad to everyone else, they concentrate on trying to win the top 14. What happens if they manage to qualify and it's like, oh, like, where does that go? Where does it fit within the season? How does it fit around with, so the travel, all of that, like logistically, there's a lot to do, but they have to figure out a way of incentivizing teams to really want to qualify it, be it financial purses, but then that comes down to TV rights. And the game financially needs to be better, in a better space. You look at all the 7 stuff that's happening at world level and obviously domestically here now. You know, seemingly the 7s guys were told that the male 7s are not going to be competing in Rugby Europe this week at the start of this week now. So, like, it's financially, how does this work? Where does it sit? Mm. And what's the purpose of it? And they've kind of just said, this is happening, but there's no details around it. So, yeah, like, look, for me, you go back to the old group stages of the Champions Cup and leave it at that, and then maybe have, you know, 8 teams or even the 2 finalists go at each other and figure something out with the Japanese or I don't know, but it just seems to be just thrown out there, and then we'll figure out all the logistics of it later on.
Yeah, I think the two of you made good points there that it might be a little bit smarter to fix the Champions Cup before setting off on this Club World Cup venture. So that's something I'm sure we'll hear a little bit more about over the next couple of years. We will keep the ball rolling. Nice little segue between Southern and Northern Hemisphere rugby, bringing us back towards the URC playoffs. Jordy Barrett, some interesting quotes from him over the last week or so. He was speaking to Sport Nation back in New Zealand, and they were talking about obviously players making the sabbatical moves to Leinster. And someone put the question to him about, like, what would you think about the younger Irish players? Have you spoken to any of the younger Irish players about them coming and playing a season over in New Zealand to just try out something different, or in Super Rugby, not just New Zealand? But he says, it's strange you ask that, especially in the Leinster system where you've got so many good players who are just wanting an opportunity. There are just passing comments when you're having a coffee saying, would you go down to New Zealand for a stint? And their eyes genuinely all light up. They'd love to head south and go that direction and play some rugby. I know we're kind of, Birch, we're kind of talking in fantasy terms a little bit here, and, you know, how realistic are all these things. But I love the idea of a young Leinster player who's maybe stuck in the queue for positions to get an opportunity to go down on loan to a Super Rugby side or similar at Munster. I think we've seen it with Munster a little bit like a Scott Buckley would have gone down and played a bit in Australia. But it feels like the players who have done that are players who are close to the exit door rather than the players who are just looking for an opportunity. I'd love to see it happen with a couple of the younger Irish players.
Yeah, we have had players play Super Rugby, like Conan O'Donnell.
And obviously Rob Kearney at the end of his career. Jack Regan
ended up, but like that was by chance, you know. He was down there playing club rugby, and
Cormac Daly as well got called in with the Reds. But that's right, it's kind of happened by chance rather than.
I, to be honest, I would love it. I would love, like, if Leinster just used them or Munster. Yeah, let's just talk about them all. But if there's a bottleneck, right, in a position, and you don't want to loan that player to another province because of the parochial nature of Irish rugby, I think it'd be absolutely perfect, you know. And, you know, and obviously the beauty of it is that the whole season doesn't overlap. So if you loan someone to the Premiership or Top 14 or Pro D2, unfortunately they're playing the same time as you. I know the Top 14 goes another month long, whatever, but playing the same time as you, whereas there's a more of a margin for the fact that they won't miss the whole season to go down there. I'd love to see it, but to be honest, I don't see any of that. I don't see any real creativity in terms of that. I think we're just tipping along, do the same stuff. Like, I'll give you an example of something that worries me. The Leinster under-18s were announced yesterday, or the day before, but there's no Black Rock College players in it, because there's something happening there that, well, I don't know what's happening, but I think, like, there's an obvious example where the top school historically and over the last couple of years aren't part of a system which you would believe is geared towards creating the next generation of Irish rugby players. So there's lots of things to fix in house in Ireland before we can even think about that. But definitely, you would say, if you're a high performing organization, you're looking for opportunities to give your players exposure in different ways. And this is, as I said before, this isn't helping any other province. It's not risking the fact that they're going to go down there and like it and stay. If they go to some another province, you're actually opening up an opportunity for them abroad. And we've been very good to do it with the likes of Angus Bell and Ione and Jordy Barrett. But could we find an opportunity for some of our young talents who are blocked up to go and be exposed to that? I think it'd be brilliant. But it's going to have to, some of the RFU is going to have to take this by the scruff of the neck if they think it's valuable and actually make it happen. It's not going to, like, you're highly likely the Highlanders are going to ring up the four provinces looking for players. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's just, it would have to start probably our way. I don't see it happening, to be honest, in the short term.
Yeah,
I'm on that school stuff, Birch. It's Rock don't send player Rock Michaels and Tanya don't send players to the 17s program, so which is the first start, which is the start of the pathway within Leinster. And then this year, Rock have taken a stand for a number of different reasons, as to they're not sending them into the schools. And the only program that they go into, which would probably be majority school leavers, are the 19s, where they're adults, so they can make their own decisions on that. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff that will probably need to be fixed close home before they have the, I suppose, as you say, the enthusiasm for something like this. But you think about what this could do for someone like Jamie Osborne, or that when there is that backlog created. You know, in my time, the opportunity to learn off those guys from Australia, New Zealand, incredible, you know, and they're a bit like your safety blanket outside of coaches, in terms of sitting down with them for a coffee, be it Aaron Major or Daryl Gibson in my early years, to Doug Howlett, and actually getting their opinion outside of a coaching member, outside of a coaching staff member. The rugby intellect they can give you. So people will say, oh, well, you know, say for instance, just Jamie, just using him as an example, because he's a younger player, Ireland international, that he's not getting the rugby IQ from Jordy Barrett, but he's getting the influence of 30 other Kiwis down there that have the same, if not more. And I think that 6 months learning in a different place, the life experience for those younger guys, or someone that's on the periphery of the academy. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a an incredible two guys coming out of school, Lee Fitzpatrick from Newbridge College, a hooker, Jack Deegan coming out of Ross Grey, two exceptional, probably the best two schoolboy players in the country. The opportunity for someone like them to go in year three of their academy instead of getting four or five appearances for Leinster that year. Leinster will have a lot of centres, they'll have a lot of hookers. They're not, but on a loan deal, if something goes really wrong, like happened with Gus McCarthy, you fly him back.
Yeah.
Jet lag in 3 or 4 days. You know what I mean? So in a really worst case scenario, you could, but it's the ability to look at that, or even first year development. Like, I know Mangan Dermid has had a great season this year, breakthrough, but what, you know, if he went last year, just for 6 months, yeah, what a placement would do. And you're learning all sorts of different things, getting a completely new, a new look on how to play rugby. And that would only be a good thing. I think it would be incredible to see, but they just need a bit more imagination. And that, look, I only, because I'm within the Leinster system, but I'm sure there's loads of Ulster guys, Munster guys, Connacht players that would have the same opportunity there. It's just having an academy system, you know, that is progressive to look at. And that's just academy. Like, someone like Jamie would fit, but, you know, why not use it earlier in their career when you know they're only going to play 3 or 4 games unless there's an injury crisis?
Yeah, just on that, like, so example would be John Devine and Connacht. So, like, you've got Bundy, you've got Hawkshaw, you've got Colin Ford, Gavin. You've got Hugh Gavin. You know, just automatically four, probably, there's probably another as well, ahead of him there. They've just given him, I think, a senior contract. Very good homegrown player. Maybe he's, like, so it's not just, maybe he's someone who could benefit from it. But just, in fairness, to coaching-wise, Nusta Poran organised for Noel Mack to go to North Harbour. Aaron Dundon this year got a sabbatical or got a break to go to ITF Cup. So, yeah, so again, like, it's not unheard of from a coaching point of view, but certainly something. And look, maybe they would argue that they're way better off at home. But have they actually analysed both sides of it? You know, or is it just an opinion that they're better off at home? And that's the question.
Mm-hmm. Right. We're going to have to move it on to the actual games this weekend. Clock is against us today, so it's going to be a quick fire URC preview, about 4 or 5 minutes long. Very quickly on Leinster and Scarlett specifically this weekend, Birch. I think for the last few weeks, we've almost been afraid to kind of too confidently predict anything around Leinster. They sent their second string to Clonethly a few weeks ago and got a decent beating. So at the very least, there should be no suggestion there'll be any Leinster complacency there. They've seen how Scarlets operate. They've seen how good they can be at times. I'm actually stunned Scarlets made it to the playoffs just based on when I saw them at Thomond Park back in February. So fair play to them. They've pulled their socks up over the last couple of months and deserve to be there now. But there's no reason why Leinster should not be winning this weekend. Am I right in saying that?
No, 100%. 100%. They obviously have to book up and have to play better than they did against Glasgow. But I don't think complacency would be part of it. The only risk for Leinster now is, you know, are they mentally damaged by another knockout failure? And can Scarlets put them in a place where they have to chase the game? You know, that's the challenge. Now, you would say Scarlets have some attacking threats that could ask questions. The problem, though, for Scarlets is, effectively, they had a great end of the season, but the last day of the season, they find out that their future's in jeopardy, you know, because of the whole thing in Welsh rugby. So, again, they were really building momentum. They seem to be very well focused. They dealt with all the contract issues that they could control. And then suddenly, now it looks like there's going to be a merger between Scarlets and Ospreys, or one of them will fold in the near future. And again, that can be a galvanizing point for some teams, or it can break other teams. So I think we know after 10, 15 minutes how they're going to handle it. And but again, that's certainly not a positive for the Scarlets. It's more than likely a negative, to be fair. You have one team who have all the resources, all the stability, all the advantages, and even another team who are not sure of the future. I mean, you know, for Leinster to lose this one, it doesn't really bear thinking about in terms of what it means for the future of Leinster.
I'll move straight to Munster and Sharks, Johnny, with you. It feels very on brand for Munster, and the story of Munster, who always give us something to talk about, that they're returning to the scene of one of this season's real low points, where, you know, beaten 41-24 at the end of October. A few days later, Graham Rowntree leaves his position as head coach. It would be very, very Munster for them to go back to Durban this weekend and pull off a big win. Now, it's also quite likely that the Sharks could win this game by 20, because the Sharks are just a team like that. You don't know what you're going to get. A bit like Bordeaux maybe earlier on in the season, what we would have said about them. I have no idea which way this game is going to go on Saturday evening.
I think of all four games, this is probably the trickiest one to call in terms of if you're having a punt on it. Like, because Munster have, you know, a performance like La Rochelle, and for a lot of the game against Bordeaux, you know, are fighting back into those positions. They obviously have the emotional attachment to a game like this with, you know, with Archer Murr and Pete finishing. So there are a lot of things in their favor, and they can draw on a lot. They've done it the hard way, you know, 2 years ago, with a lot of the same group. So yeah, it is one of those in the history of Munster. It can be built up to, this is going to be one of their performances. I anticipated it is going to be that. It's going to be really tight, but you look at what the Sharks have, you know, in terms of their extra quality in terms of just on paper, and that then, but it is, you couldn't predict this with any, you know, what having a banker on this team is going to win it, where you look at the others and you'd be fairly close to, you know, I think it's going to be three other home wins, where this one is, oh, you know, just from a punting perspective. So hopefully it lends itself to another La Rochelle performance and a historic, you know, they'll get another couple of weeks down in South Africa.
What way are you leaning, Bernard? I'll give you the last
one. Yeah, I like Munster. I think Munster have halfbacks who are flying and have good injury profile at the moment. Knockout rugby. The Sharks, for me, are just too erratic. Obviously, talent-wise, the Sharks should win, but I fancy Munster.
Very good. Live blog of that Sharks against Munster and of Leinster Scarlets on Saturday on rt.ie/sport. Commentary as well of both on RT Radio 1 and Leinster against Scarlets live on RT 2 and RT Player from 2:30 p.m. Kickoff is at 3 o'clock. Berners, Johnny, thanks a million for joining us, and we'll speak to you again very soon.
Thank you.